Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. His books include The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, The American Way of Strategy, and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And Michael Lind has a three-part series of articles at Salon.com, Private Sector Parasites, How Rich Mooches Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And your articles at Salon.com, of course, they have very provocative titles, but it would seem to me that the American people need to wake up to the reality of what American capitalism has become. You describe it as a kind of rentier capitalism. So explain the difference between rents and profits.
Well, economists used to distinguish between rents, which are extracted from society by people who control valuable resources, which could be natural resources, it could be creditors with privileged rights to create money, and profits, which are earned by businesses, you know, by selling goods and services that people want. So if you are the owner of a toll bridge and every time someone passes, you have to pay a toll, and you're just earning this money for no effort whatsoever, it's completely passive activity, then you're a classic of rentier or rentier, as they say in France. If you are in the business of, let's say, making new tablets and selling them to people who want this new appliance, and your income comes from the results of this innovation, then you're a classic capitalist. What I argue in my Salon series is that a lot of economists and many conservatives and libertarians have forgotten the distinction between rentiers, these purely passive money extractors, and actual entrepreneurs and business executives, and the business workers, too, who are adding something to society. And I go beyond that and argue that to really understand the economy, there are indeed takers and makers. There are productive people and unproductive people. But the takers are not all in the private sector, or all in the public sector, and the makers are not all in the private sector. You can't have a flourishing modern industrial economy without a good school system, without an infrastructure system, without good governance. So that's an essential part of the productive economy in the public sector. At the same time, all private money-making activities are not productive. They don't necessarily add to the long-term capability of the economy to produce goods and services using technology at a lower price.
Well, I thought, for example, the toll booth owner was the person who built the road and therefore was entitled to pay for it through tolls. But, I mean, aren't there better examples like hedge fund managers who basically handle the money of wealthy people and essentially make money for themselves and make money for wealthy people?
Well, and also a lot of there's the other distinction that needs to be made besides that between rents and profits is between real serious investments in productive enterprises and speculation in assets. So if I'm rich and I invest in a breakthrough new technology that transforms the world for the better, you know, that's what capitalism does well. If I use the same amount of money and invest it because I want to corner the world market for Picasso paintings and then sell them at a premium, that has done nothing, you know, to increase the productivity of the actual economy of goods and services. It's just pure speculation.
And nothing's more, I think, a more graphic example of pure speculation is these microsecond trades that go on and these high-speed computer trades that go on Wall Street, which a lot of the hedge funds are behind, where they just literally churn over billions of stocks for milliseconds and make tiny fractions of profits, but it all adds up.
Yeah, they're leveraging currencies or, in some cases, imperfections in the stock market that ordinary investors can't detect, and it really serves no useful function in terms of long-term, patient, steady investment in productivity-enhancing enterprises, which is why a lot of economists, including the late James Tobin of Yale, have proposed taxing it as just a form of unproductive gambling. He proposed a Tobin tax, a small financial transactions tax that could generate a lot of money for governments. At the same time, it's a kind of a sin tax. And sin taxes actually are, so-called sin taxes, are the traditional response of governments to unproductive activities. You're not going to outlaw them. At least you can tax them and raise revenue from them. What a lot of governments do as well is to prevent the rentiers from making excessive amounts of money at the expense of the rest of the economy, is to have very high taxes on rents, in some cases property taxes. A lot of countries, including Australia and Canada, have super profits taxes or resource taxes on natural resources, on the theory that the mere fact that there's a rare earth mine on your property, really you've done nothing to justify having a vast fortune as a result of that. Compared to a real entrepreneur, it's just an accident of land title. And in the case of Canada, the taxes from the resource extraction, in some cases, are redistributed among all the provinces on the theory that it's unfair that a single province or state should have the benefits of this geographic accident.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and author of Land of Promise and Economic History of the United States, and he has a three-part series of articles at Salon.com, Private Sector Parasites, How Rich Mooches Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. So, obviously, it's become culturally acceptable. The new definition of capitalist, as you point out in your article, it's not about the productive entrepreneur or the successful industrialist, but anybody who makes money nowadays. And this has led to these people like these payday lenders and this for-profit college racket. In both of those cases, it's the federal government that allows these parasites to make money because they make campaigns to politicians. And it really gets down to our campaign finance system, where they can simply bribe enough congresspeople to steal people blind. In the case of the education racket with these for-profit colleges, that's all federal money that they're making money on.
Well, that's right. And if you look at federal, state, and local levels, the traditional argument for having public education, including public universities and colleges, was that this was kind of a natural monopoly or oligopoly, and just like sewage and water and electricity, and you wanted to provide it to your citizens at cost without needing to pay shareholders super profits or, you know, enormous bonuses and benefits to the managers. What we see now with this trend towards privatization and the replacement of social insurance with, private for-profit plans, you know, like Paul Ryan's plan for voucherizing Medicare, that's the worst of all worlds, because you would pressure, or in some cases through individual mandates, compel people to buy these private substitutes for former public programs. But at the same time, these would be profit-making enterprises, and so you would have forcing your citizens to pay for the salaries and the compensation of very well-remunerated executives and shareholders.
Well, this is, I think, again, because of the power of money, and because we have a political campaign system based upon money. So he who has the most money controls the most politics in this country. And so that's led to the oligarchs essentially taking over and writing laws, and they have their faithful servants in the Congress. And they've created a system for themselves where they privatize their gains while they socialize their losses.
Well, I think progressives really need to make this distinction as well, because what I'm arguing is not simply the usual line that there are special interests exploiting the public. There are good special interests and bad special interests. Now, it may very well be that farmers and miners and manufacturers rig laws in their favor to have, you know, good depreciation allowances or a subsidy here or there. But if at the end of the day, they are creating a more productive economy and everybody's benefiting from it, you know, you can forgive a certain amount of subsidy. If it's a purely wasteful activity, like replacing Social Security with for-profit annuities and forcing hundreds of millions of seniors just to pay management fees to money managers on Wall Street, then, you know, there's no benefit to the economy from that at all. It's a net loss, except to the individuals who profit from this what's called rent-seeking activity. So the point is not that that government is good or business is bad or vice versa, that there are rent-extracting elements in both the private and the public sector, just as there are productive elements on both sides.
So, Michael Lind, obviously, to redefine or at least define our current form of capitalism accurately and make the distinction between finance capitalism, rentier capitalism, and industrial capitalism, which is what we used to have and what we still think of in large part, even though the extractive types have basically taken over, and Wall Street is, of course, the poster boy of extractive capitalism, and Mitt Romney was the poster boy of their perfect representative. So at least we can breathe a sigh of relief that he didn't become president. But what can be done then, apart from the first stage, meaning the wake-up call, which is what your articles at Salon.com are providing? But you're basically saying this: it's going to require a populist campaign, right, to force this unproductive form of capitalism to basically take away its privileges.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, maybe it would need a coalition of progressives and some Main Street conservatives, and it would cut across party lines to some extent. I got pushback by including higher education in the rent-extracting, unproductive sector, because a lot of progressives have very idealized utopian view of the higher education system. In fact, it's become arguably parasitic. That's not to say there aren't good professors and great schools. But if you look at the last generation, the costs have just exploded way out of proportion to increases in economic growth. The tuition has exploded. 50% of undergraduates now are taught by non-tenured lecturers and adjuncts who make slightly above poverty level wages. You know, some of them make $14,000, $15,000, $16,000 a year. So that system is clearly broken. The medical system in the United States, in addition to the actual valuable medical services that are provided, there's also just pure extraction by monopolistic pharma companies, by, frankly, a lot of overpaid specialty physicians, not so much the general practitioners, and by hospitals. And we just know this to be the case because if you compare the U.S. to very similar societies, including Canada and Western Europe, the same things, the same items like aspirin and doctor's visits and hospitals and appendectomies cost twice as much in the U.S.
Or much more, actually.
Or more than twice as much, yeah. So that's just pure waste. And usually the argument for making the economy more efficient takes the form of conservative arguments for attacking middle-class entitlements and slashing wages and destroying unions. I think you can have a progressive or even progressive-slash-centrist efficiency agenda where you squeeze out a lot of the private sector waste. And of course, you should go after public sector waste, you know, in the Defense Department, for example, where it exists at the same time.
Well, Michael Lind, I was going to suggest that the place to start maybe in terms of creating a kind of populist movement here to essentially get rid of this parasitic form of capitalism that's dominating our economy, that the millennial generation might be the place to start. Student loan debt now has passed $1 trillion mark, second only to household mortgage debt. And these kids are getting ripped off by, you say, as you mentioned, by the public sector and private or universities, as well as, of course, the government-subsidized for-profits, which are outright rackets, where they indenture them for life and give them worthless diplomas.
The poster boy for a rent-extracting parasitic industry is the student loan industry, which got Congress – this was unbelievable when I just learned this recently. But in the last decade, they persuaded Congress to write laws so that student loans cannot be discharged in bankruptcy.
Right.
The whole point of bankruptcy is to free people from debts that they cannot pay.
Right, but if you have this unit, this generation that's getting ripped off and indentured, and there are no jobs for them, that's a good place to start, isn't it, with mobilizing a movement?
I think so, and I think that the millennial generation, it really hasn't found any leaders. There's a time lag. Even Obama really reflects more the worldview of the 1990s Clinton neoliberals in many ways, rather than the younger generation. The older generation of neoliberals in the 90s and the early 2000s had this you know, win-win view of the future. We were all going to be well-paid knowledge workers, you know, inventing things, and other countries could make things, and you know, you could work on Wall Street, or you could you know, maybe write software programs or something like that.
Right, the great information highway that Al Gore was beckoning us to.
Yeah, and so in the actual real world of the United States, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the majority of jobs being created now are essentially jobs that require only on-the-job training beyond high school, and they tend to be low-paid service jobs, healthcare aides, fast food preparers, and others. If you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics site, where they talk about jobs of tomorrow, apart from registered nurses and teachers, there are no college-educated professional jobs being created in the list of the most numerous jobs at all. And so, you know, I think to that kind of progressivism, this sort of feel-good, happy-talk progressivism where everyone's going to go to college and then, you know, get this very well-paying professional job, that's been discredited by events just as much as the right-wing ownership society in which the janitors, you know, don't need higher wages because they're just going to be counting their returns from their stock market investments.
So just in closing, Michael Lind, what do you think are the chances of a real dialogue? Because you're trying to start a debate here with your articles at Salon.com amongst the economists and the policymakers and the pundits. Do you have any sense that people are really interested in really looking deeper at the very nature of our capitalism? I mean, we've got...
Well, I think so. The response to this particular series of articles in Salon was very encouraging. I got more response to that than anything I'd written in a long time. And I'm not the only one who's talking about this. If you look at writers like Mike Konzol and various others, the economist Michael Hudson, there's even this term rentier, which is kind of an obscure, antiquated term that most people don't understand, somebody who just lives on rents or passive investment. This is gradually bubbling up in discourse. Now, there's a time lag. It sort of works. It begins in the intellectual community and then filters into journalism and then into broader public discussion. But I think that there's certainly an audience waiting for a story of what has gone on with the economy other than the New Democrat story that we just need to deregulate everything and send more people to universities, and the right stories, which is just that we should privatize entitlements and cut taxes on the rich. I don't think either of those are going to win assent, particularly from this younger generation you're talking about.
Well, Michael Lind, I thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. His books include The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, The American Way of Strategy, and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And Michael Lind has a three-part series of articles at Salon.com, Private Sector Parasites, How Rich Moochers Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was back in America.
the headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.